Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. The true story of the night innocence and evil crossed paths. On a summer night in 2000, Amy Shute and Jason Bergeson were set upon by five predatory youths outside a Providence, Rhode Island club. It began as a twisted joyride for the young kidnappers. It ended in cold-blooded murder and a town's relentless fight for justice. The book that we're featuring this evening is Murder Without Motive, the Amy Shute and Jason Bergeson story, with my special guest, retired detective and author Raymond Pigatori. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Raymond Pigatori. Welcome to the program, Raymond Pigatori.
Good afternoon, Dan, and how are you today?
Oh, fine. Thank you very much. Let's talk about initially, just like in this book here, this happened and occurred in June 8th, 2000, and this is in Providence, Rhode Island, and you talk about Jason Bergeson and Amy Shute. Tell us a little bit about you, where you were as a detective at that time. You said you were a junior detective, as you write in the book. Tell us where you were in your career before we talk about the circumstances when you heard about this crime and got intimately and inextricably involved.
Well, as far as being the junior detective, I had been in detectives for approximately 8 or 9 years at that point, but we still had many senior detectives over me who handled a majority of the major crimes that came in. On this particular day, it was a summer day, pretty much, and many had gone on vacation or took days off, etc. And I happened to be the low man on the pole, so I was working that day along with two other, a BCI officer and a narcotics officer. So we were at a skeleton crew for the day.
Right.
When the call did actually come in, it came in around noontime of that day, and then prior to that, it had been relatively quiet. And when the call came in, I walked into dispatch, and ironically, I was just about ready to order lunch with one of the patrol officers, and they called me Ping at the time, and he turned to me. He said, "Ping, you got to get down to the golf course that was under construction in our town." He said there was they just found two bodies.
Right. Now, as you do, as you write in the book, on June 8th, you talked about several days before Jason Bergeson and Amy Shute. Now, who are these young people? How old were these people? And tell us about their relationship and what happened. What were they planning to do? What was the relationship about? How long have they known each other? Tell us a little bit about their relationship and what they were planning to do on that June evening in 2000.
Well, Jason Bergeson and Amy, they were relatively new in their relationship, just dating several months. Both were into music. Jason had gone to St. Cloud University, and he was an inspiring DJ. And Amy, at the time, was taking some time off from going to the University of Rhode Island, and she was working. And on the night of the incident, they had made plans with several of their other friends to go to a a dance club in Providence and just do what, you know, normal kids do. And when I say kids, they were, you know, early 20s, late teens, and they just wanted to have a good time, as many teens would want to do. And ultimately, they ended up in the city of Providence.
Now, you introduce a character that's important to the story, and especially right in the very beginning, as statistically, something like this might make police look at this person quite seriously when something were happen close to him, like this Amy shoot. Talk about Jeffrey Harper and who he was and what happened that night with him and Amy.
Jeffrey Harper was a former boyfriend of Amy Shute, but he tried to remain relatively friendly with her, and they were on speaking terms. Jeff realized that Amy was moving on in her relationships, and she, again, just started dating Jason. Jeff kind of called Amy, and Amy expressed that her and a group of friends, along with Jason, were going to go to a nightclub in Providence, and that, you know, he was welcome to come, but she also had made the understanding that, you know, she is now strictly friends with him. Their relationship has terminated, but their friendship still carried on.
Yeah. And there was plans that you write about, too, as well, because they were close friends. And despite the relationship with Jason, he still expressed and they made plans to call each other when?
Jeff had gone to the club with the other group of people, Amy and Jason and friends. And when Amy was going to be dropped off by Jason and go home for the night, Jeff had expressed to her that he would like her to call just to check in, no matter what time she got in. And that call never came. Once she left the club, things went downhill rather quickly.
Now, with this book, you introduce these other characters and have this meanwhile moment while these kids basically are enjoying themselves. They like dancing and they love music and they have quite a few friends and they're just straight good kids with the lives and careers ahead of them. Meanwhile, you introduce Gregory Floyd and Kenneth Day. Now, these guys are roommates, and you describe in the book the kind of room that these guys share and the kind of people they were going out that evening to play some pool, you say, but they brought a gun. Tell us a little bit about Gregory Floyd and Kenneth Day and their living conditions and what they were doing that evening.
Well, just to get back to Jason and Amy for one second, when you just said that they were, you know, everyday good kids, I can't reiterate enough on just how good these kids were. They were, you know, everybody's son, everybody's daughter. You know, you would beam with joy if they were your kids. Floyd and Kenneth Day were the total opposite. You know, they were bad from the get-go. Kenneth Day had allowed Greg Floyd to move into Kenneth Day's apartment. Greg Floyd had just recently been released from, it's called the ACI, which is the Adult Correctional Institution, which is our prison here in Rhode Island. He had served a short time, a couple of months, if I recall, and when he got out, he moved in with Kenneth Day. Kenneth Day and Floyd, they lived in a place that was like absolute squalor. It was, you know, a place that makes your skin crawl when you walk in and walk out. And, you know, it was just like a nightmare to even fathom how anybody would want to live in those conditions.
Right. Now, you talk about these two guys downtown, and one of them has a gun, and they talk about seeing a guy named that they call a custy, which somebody's looking for drugs. So tell us what they encounter, what their plan is that's cooked up seemingly spontaneously or on the fly here. Tell us about that.
Well, on the fly is a definitely a key term. They did not truly have a plan formulated throughout the entire night. However, Kenneth Day was down, we call it down city. That's the terminology we use for Providence. Even if you live in the city of Providence, you're going down into the heart of the city. Kenneth Day had been at a local pool hall, and he was a wheeler dealer type of person. And if he could make a buck in any way, shape, or form, he would make a buck. And when I say that, if it was whether it was robbing somebody, whether it was trying to sell drugs to somebody, in this particular incident, when he was at the pool hall, someone had approached about buying drugs or selling drugs and had flashed around some money, and which piqued Kenneth Day's interest big time. So he had got a hold of Floyd and said, Floyd, get down to the city. The city's hot right now. I got a cussy that I'm looking to rob, and he's close by, so bring your gun, which Floyd did.
Right. Now, what are the circumstances where they hook up with Burdick and Samuel Sanchez and Raymond Anderson? Tell us about that.
Well, it's pretty interesting. Burdick was a person that was known in the city of Providence. He was a heavier set kid that his he would hang up in near the Brown University, which is a well-renowned elite school. But he would hang around that area. He would purchase drugs around that area. And he was actually waiting at a bus stop to go home to Pawtucket, which is adjacent to Providence. Floyd and Kenneth Day had hooked up with Anderson and Sammy Sanchez. So they were riding around city, and they happened to see Burdick at the bus stop. Floyd knew Burdick from hanging down in Providence. They pull over, and Floyd says, hey, come on, the city's, you know, basically the city's hot tonight. There's a lot of students in the city. On Thursday nights, most of the college, there's several colleges in the state of Rhode Island, several in the city area. The kids go down on a Thursday night, and it seems to be a big college night where they're all out dancing, walking around. So there's a vast amount of people, a vast amount of targets in the eyes of Kenneth Day and company. So once the five collectively got together, their mindset became one. And their one mindset was to go out and find someone they could rob. So that's what they did after they picked up Burdick at the bus stop, was right around the city looking for a target to rob.
You write that Burdick steals some latex gloves, and meanwhile you talk about Jason and Amy. The club ends closes at 1 o'clock, and as we spoke, Amy is expecting a call maybe at 2 or 2:30. So after the club and with their friends, what happens with Amy and Jason, and how do they get separated with their friends, and what do they do after that club?
Well, Burdick and Floyd have frequented this pizza establishment. They used to help the owner of the pizza place, Sacky's Pizza. They used to help the owner unload trucks and did meaningless jobs around the pizza place, and in turn the owner would give them free pizza, etc. So it wasn't uncommon for them to be inside the pizza place at all given hours. It was one of these establishments that was open to like 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. So when they happened to walk into this Sacky's Pizza, they made a beeline for the kitchen area, and they went right to the latex gloves. They grabbed the gloves and they passed them out amongst the five of them. So right there in my mind, it's telling me that a plan is really starting to kick in motion, that if they do something illicit, they're going to do it where they're not going to leave evidence behind, such as a fingerprint. Now, what had happened when Jason and Amy went to the nightclub? Prior to going to the nightclub to dance, they went to a ballroom pool hall kind of place, and their other friends from Massachusetts, it was agreed upon that they would meet at this place called Tommy's Place. They met there, they played some pool, et cetera, and then they left their car at the Tommy's Place and went to this other nightclub. Once that nightclub let out for the night, they went back to Tommy's Place. Their friends left. So that left Jason and Amy alone in the parking lot. So they didn't want the night to end. They just sat outside of Jason's vehicle, and they were listening to music, as kids do, and they were just hanging out, bothering nobody at this particular time. Except Floyd and Day and Sammy Sanchez and Ray Anderson and Harry Burdick, they had their own ideas of having a good time, and that was to rob somebody. And their entire night, instead of being like normal, you know, teenage, early 20-year-olds enjoying a nightclub scene, they were riding around the entire Down City area looking to rob somebody. And they would pick out various targets, and for whatever reason, their attempts would fail. I mean, they only made one actual attempt to rob somebody when they surrounded somebody at an ATM machine, and a security guard happened to intervene, and that had failed for them. So their ultimate goal that night was to set out to make an easy buck.
Now, you write that you find out later, much later, that they had already spotted Jason's vehicle, a white Ford Explorer. And then you say that this crew of five spotted the Explorer again.
Well,
go ahead. Sorry.
When Floyd and company had been riding around Down City looking for various targets, it wasn't really panning out. So Harry Burdick said to Floyd and Sammy Sanchez, who was Sammy Sanchez's car, he said, "Hey, look, just get me back to Pawtucket. I want to go home." And Sammy Sanchez basically told him, "It's not happening. I'm not driving you to Pawtucket. You want to get home, you go steal a car." Now, they had spotted Jason and Amy hanging outside their car, listening to music, but they had seen them earlier. So they circle around, back around the city. They park on a side street. This is Floyd and Burdick and company. And it was at that time a plan was formulated by Floyd and Burdick. Burdick said, "I'll go rob that car and I'll drive home." So it was at that time that Burdick and Floyd exited Sammy Sanchez's car, walked through an alleyway, and walked up to Jason and Amy, and at gunpoint told both of them, "We're taking your car, but get in it first." So in essence, they carjacked Jason and Amy at that point.
Horrifyingly, you write that a patrol officer had spotted Jason and Amy at some point. Tell us about this close brush these people didn't avoid this calamity, but the police were very close in proximity.
When I say close in proximity, it was so close that, you know, Amy could have reached out or yelled out or done whatever and said, "Help me." The patrol officer was probably a couple hundred feet away, or maybe a little bit more than that. He had watched when Floyd and Burdick put Amy and Jason into Jason's vehicle. Floyd was in the driver's seat at this time. Jason and Amy were in the back seat, and Harry Burdick was in the front passenger seat, and Harry Burdick had the gun faced on Jason and Amy. Floyd drives Jason's car out the wrong way of a one-way street. It was a short alleyway, but it was still a roadway, and it was still, you know, indicated it was one way. And when Floyd came driving out the wrong way on a one-way street, this was observed by this officer at the time, and he did nothing. The officer never stopped him. He just looked at him, and Floyd continued on his way.
Yeah. So back
horrifying
at
to Danny and Jason, it was just horrifying knowing that, you know, they're looking at the police and, you know, potentially they could have been saved at that point, and, you know, nothing was done.
Yeah. Now, back with Amy and Jason, how aware or not aware of the situation are they? What are the perps Floyd and Burdick saying to these two people about their future, basically? What were they saying? What was Amy asking? What were these guys saying to this couple?
Amy was asking basically what's going to happen with us, and Floyd was trying to calm her down, saying we're just going to go for a ride, we're going to ride around the city, and he started getting into attempting to get into a normal conversation with Amy, where do you go to school, what do you do now, and he's trying to engage her in a conversation, which at how would one person respond to that when you're being held at gunpoint and here's a person trying to talk to you in a normal sense and when everything was as abnormal as could be? And they, once they drove out that alleyway, they were then, Sammy Sanchez in his car, which still contained Sammy Sanchez, Ray Anderson, and Kenneth Day, they dropped in behind Floyd, who was now, driving Jason's vehicle. They just dropped in behind him and started following him around city. So here's Floyd, Burdick, Jason, and Amy in one car, the other three individuals in their car, and they were just driving around following each other until ultimately they got tired of driving around the city, and that's when Sammy Sanchez really kicked it in motion.
You write about what they initially asked this. Of course, these guys are looking for money, so they did try in their primitive plan to look at people or target people that might have money. So the question was, they asked these people about money. How much money did Amy and Jason have? What happens with that request?
Well, that comes a little bit later. Once Sanchez, driving his vehicle, said to Floyd, "Follow me, I know where to go." And that place that he took him to was the golf course that was under construction. So once they got to that golf course, that's when they really started ramping it up, saying, "Give us your money, give us whatever you got, whether it be jewelry, whether it be credit cards, whatever it was, anything of any type of intrinsic value, they were going to take." And Amy and Jason at that point will say, "We'll give you everything we have. We only have, so much money. Take the car and take our money and just leave us, please, and we'll never report the car stolen. We'll never call the police, but just leave us and take whatever we can give you." And that dollar amount that ultimately Floyd and company succeeded in getting from Amy and Jason was a grand total of $18.
Right. Who initiates the conversation about that they could identify them and so they must die? Who does that?
That was Kenneth Day. And Kenneth Day, although he did not pull the trigger, he was, in my estimation, probably one of the most evil people I've ever met. And he was the catalyst behind them. When I say them collectively, Floyd, Burdick, Anderson, Sanchez, and Day killing Jason and Amy. And Kenneth Day had indicated to Floyd that we have to kill them. They saw our faces. And he had been trying to shield his face when they were driving around. And when Sanchez drove up and was side by side with Floyd, and when Floyd was driving Jason's car, he put his hand over his face to try to obscure the view that they would have had of him. And then he said, let's kill him. They saw us.
You write about Kenneth Day. When they realized, again, in their twisted logic, that these people must die, then there was a statement about, well, what the hell? What did Day say about regarding Amy, and what were the plans, and what happened with those plans with Amy?
Well, Kenneth Day and Ray Anderson were sitting, they remained inside the Ford Explorer when they told Jason to get out of the car. When they pulled down inside this golf course area, they said, get out of the car, and they left Amy in the car. Kenneth Day started telling Amy that he wanted sexual favors from her, and if she did fulfill those, he would basically help her out in some way or form. And by helping her out, he was, making overtures that he would, spare her a life. And she had told him straight out. She said, "Listen, please don't do anything to me. I'm pregnant." And that kind of stopped the whole process. So she was not pregnant. She just told him that she was. And at that time, nothing occurred. No sexual assault occurred.
You write that one of these unconscionable killers had something to say about these guys sexually assaulting Amy, though.
Well, ironically, and I don't even know if I want to call it ironically, for a fleeting moment, Greg Floyd, who was, I don't want to say he was the mastermind behind this whole process, but he was the one who took the gun to the scene. And he, at that time, told both Kenneth Day and Ray Anderson, leave her alone, don't touch her. And I actually asked Floyd that at once he was brought into custody. You know, you were there, you had the gun, you were in charge, you were in control. You stopped the sexual assault upon Amy, but then you followed through with ultimately the murder of them.
Yeah.
Which is, it's hard to fathom that, and it really truly is. All I envisioned was here are two innocent kids pleading for their lives. You know, and after pleading for their lives, you know, then they want to introduce a sexual assault to her, and Floyd stops that. And when I just asked them, it blew me away. Like, how could you stop one thing and carry through on the most egregious act that you could commit on somebody?
Yeah, yeah. And with this too, you talk about Harry Burdick. At this point, says, "I'm out of here." What happens when this guy tries to get away from these guys? Who is in his corner and who isn't? And what are they accusing him of, potentially?
Well, Harry Burdick was friends with Greg Floyd. And what had happened was he suddenly got a case of the guilts and said, when they were down inside the golf course and they had Jason and Amy out of the vehicle, leaning up against bales of hay, sitting on the ground, and there were kids were yelling back and forth, Floyd and company, about murdering this innocent couple. Harry Burdick basically said, I don't want no part of this. And he started walking away. He said, listen, I'm leaving. At that point, Sammy Sanchez said to Greg Floyd, basically, and then in this vernacular, he's your boy, go get him, or I'm going to kill him. And that's when Floyd and put Jason and Amy back inside the Ford Explorer, and now at this time there's like seven of them in this vehicle, attached to the vehicle, and they're riding up the hill trying to get a hold of Harry Burdick. And they said, Harry, get back down here. And they drove back down inside the golf course. Once again, had Jason and Amy sitting against bales of hay, and that's when things really went bad.
Now, what do Amy and Jason think? I know you write that Jason is reassuring Amy that everything will be okay. She hasn't been sexually assaulted. What happens next with this group of five and Amy and Jason?
Just to give you a vision of how despairing this moment was, Amy is sitting there clutching Jason, and he's trying to reassure her as they're pleading with these five individuals, leave us alone, let us go, we won't report the car stolen, we gave you our money, everything we've had. And he was trying to put his, put his best word forward to these individuals, saying, "Please leave us alone, Amy. This is going to be okay. Basically, I'm your protector. I'm your boyfriend. I'm going to help you, whether it be in words or in actions at that particular moment. I'll never know. Ultimately, once these five individuals that are standing before them." With the, several feet in front of them, and Floyd's got the gun in his hand, and they're yelling back and forth, and Kenneth Day is really ramping things up, saying, you got to kill him, you got to kill him. And Sammy Sanchez turns and says to Floyd, if you don't kill them, I will. And then Floyd was, at that point, said, listen, stop, and walked over. And, again, the kids are looking up, they're pleading for their life. And just for that moment prior to the actual, and this was an execution, that's what it came down to, they're looking at this individual, and he's covering that short distance and span from them, and they're looking at him knowing that at this point their lives are over. So Floyd shoots Jason, and now, I'm trying to think of the mindset of Amy, who was either, she was alive for a fleeting second, for a minute, we do not know, but she was alive long enough to see her boyfriend executed. And just the horrors in her mind at that point, knowing that she's going to be next. And ultimately she was.
Incredible. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor, which is Brewmate. Don't you just love warm alcohol? Well, neither did Dylan, the founder of Brewmate. That's why he made it Brewmate's mission to shake up the beverage industry for the better. Brewmate's stylish, insulated drinkware is designed to keep your favorite beverages ice cold all day long. Whatever your tastes in beer, wine, or spirits, Brewmate makes sure every sip is the perfect temperature. My wife and I used again our wine insulator and two uncorked extra large wine glasses that we had got from Brewmate. We chose it in the glitter rose gold color. My wife Lisa loved the color and design. We went out on a Sunday. It was another beautiful day, and we decided to go to the marina, bought some food, and our Brewmate wine cellar and our two uncorked extra large wine glasses. Brewmate has some lining in the wine cellar, so doesn't have any metallic taste. Our wine stayed cold and refreshing and delicious all day. The glasses were perfect, and the wine cellar and the glasses look great. It fits a full bottle of wine and includes a silicone funnel for either easy transferring. The wine cellar maintains the perfect temperature for over 24 hours. Bring your wine on the go without worrying about keeping it chilled. No more broken bottles or tickets for bringing glass into glass-free zones. The uncorked wine glasses are the largest insulated wine glass in the world, fitting over a half a bottle of wine, 14 ounces, comes with a splash-proof lid, 30 colors available, the perfect gift for the stylish wine lover in your life. Don't settle for warm alcohol. Chill out with your favorite drinks all day long with Brewmate. Visit brewmate.com and add code MURDER to get 15% off your first order. That's 15% off your first order when you go to brewmate.com and add code MURDER. Now, we just went and had you recount the grisly details of the last minutes of Jason and Amy's lives. What do the five perpetrators do? What is their plan now that they've killed? Tell us what happens next with the five before we talk about what happens with the discovery and the investigation that's soon underway.
Well, the five individuals just left Jason and Amy for dead in a golf course, got inside Jason's Ford Explorer, divvied up some change and some cash that they had found in the Ford Explorer. And when I say divvied up, they went to a gas station nearby in the city of Providence, and they put $9 in gas in each of the vehicles, that being Sanchez's car and Jason's car. So they ultimately they got $18, but it was $18 spent on gasoline. Mm-hmm. So
you
two
talk
kids
about
was snuffed out for $18.
You write about that there was a plan for another crime using the vehicle. Tell us what that was, and then who was assigned the vehicle, and what were they told to do with it?
Floyd was in charge of the vehicle, and there had been some talk that the following day they were going to use that vehicle to rob something else. But Floyd said, well, I'll keep the vehicle close by to his house. And he had kept it overnight, and the following day drove around with his car that, you know, he killed somebody for, like it was his own vehicle, his own personal pleasure vehicle. He had the keys to it, and he used it at will.
Now, you read about that there was a few of these perpetrators had girlfriends and people in their lives, and they made comments, and other people made, tell us about some of the things that were said initially and to who.
Well, there was some bragging rights by both Ray Anderson, Kenneth Day, even Floyd, who was talking to his girlfriend about what had transpired the night before. And they were saying how bad they were, and bad in a sense of, you know, look at me, I'm a tough guy, I'm a murderer, I'm on top of the world in their small, demented kind of world that they lived in. These are people, strictly street people, where the value of life, the value of people's property holds nothing to them. So if they bragged about a murder to a friend and the friend listened to that story, the friends that they had were not the normal type friends that the normal type person would have. You know, nobody reached out and called the police and said, hey, Jason was killed last night, and Greg Floyd told me about it, or Kenneth Day told me about it. They didn't have that type of conscience.
Mm-hmm. Now tell us about your involvement with this investigation. It's right after this, the discovery of the bodies. What can you determine, you and your team, from the crime scene itself? What bit of evidence do you have to go from there, and how do you proceed?
Well, originally, this golf course was under construction, as I said earlier, and the one of the maintenance men that was the like the supervisor of the golf course had observed off in the distance what he perceived to be bags of garbage. Again, this is a kind of a secluded area. Half the golf course is in Providence. The other half of the golf course is in Johnston. When ultimately around lunchtime, the groundskeeper drove up to pick up his so-called bag of garbage, he realized that he had saw a dead person. He thought it was a mannequin at first, but then he realized it was a dead person. And that's when he had called 911. The dispatch went to Providence, who responded to the scene first, but they also notified Johnston police because it was so close to the dividing line of the two cities and towns. I get down to the scene, and I've been on the force for some time at this point. I knew where the dividing line was, and I walked in. And I said, "Hey, you know, guys, this is Johnston's scene. We took over the investigation, and in any investigation, you need to, number one, determine who these people are. These two people are someone's son, daughter, aunt, uncle, brother, sister, and we needed to find out who they are, and first and foremost, if we also had what type of crime scene we had. Was it a murder-suicide? Was it a was it a drug-induced overdose? Because there wasn't a tremendous amount of carnage left by the gunshot wounds. It was kind of hard to determine what it was. And again, you try to keep an open mind on an investigation, and if you get tunnel vision, it could definitely hamper the investigation. So we leave all options open, and then what we proceeded to do was start canvassing the area for any type of evidence that may be left behind. There was no vehicle at the scene, but there were tire tracks leading up to Jason and Amy. So that indicated they had got there somehow, some way, and most likely it was with a vehicle. But again, those tracks could have been there prior to them. We have to leave an open mind to all possible things that come our way.
When you're investigating this crime, I know this might be out of chronological order, but while you're investigating this, there's a call comes to the police station. But again, construct this process for us up to that point where that call comes in and that information is added to what you do know so far.
Well, once at the scene, as we're trying to determine who these individuals were, Jason and Amy, we had start canvassing the area, and we had started expanding our crime scene out, and we locate a wallet, a female's wallet, several hundred feet away from the bodies. We start going through the wallet, and there is different credit cards, et cetera, with Amy's name on it. We now have a tentative identification of who Amy is, but we still needed a positive identification. That was from the medical examiner's office at the time. The ME, the medical examiner, he'd come out to the scene because in Rhode Island, and I don't know, I can't speak for other states, they have control over the scene when there's bodies involved, and then they release the scene back to us at the detectives to investigate.
Right.
So we needed to determine who these individuals were. That was done. A positive identification of Amy was made by Amy's mom and her boyfriend, which just to make the notification to the families is one of the hardest tasks that is ever put upon a police officer. There's no training for that, and it is the worst thing. And to this day, you know, it gives me a knot in my stomach knowing that, you know, you have to walk up to people you don't know to know at all, knock on their door and say, you know, are you the parents of, and can you come and identify your child? They've been a victim of a murder. And it was just it's burned into my brain. It's just horrific. But getting back to the investigation, once we have the kids identified and we have Jason's dad telling us, you know, Jason had a Ford Explorer, where is it? He gives us the license plate on the Ford Explorer. We put out a BOLO, a be on the lookout for his vehicle. Ultimately, it's stopped in the city of Providence by a at the time a patrolman, Giancarella, and in the inside the vehicle, it was being driven by Greg Floyd. Johnston, Rhode Island Police Department, myself, and several other detectives respond to the scene in Providence. We take Greg Floyd back into our custody at this time to speak to him about why he has Jason's vehicle. As we're speaking to Jason, as we're speaking to Greg Floyd, we receive a phone call at the police station from a person identifying himself as Harry Burdick. Harry Burdick informs one of the detectives over the phone that while watching the 10 o'clock news, he learned about that the Johnston police were investigating the murders of the two individuals at the golf course. Harry tells us he knows about the scene and is he in trouble? And so we tell Harry, listen, we don't know what story you're going to tell us, but please come to the police station so whatever information you may have, we can start using that as evidence or helping us go forward with our investigation, not so much evidence. I now had left Greg Floyd in the interview room by himself. After talking to the detectives who spoke to Harry, I walked back into the interview room, and I had told Greg Floyd, I said, Greg, we got a problem here. The story that you told me in the beginning, how, you know, you had nothing to do with the car, you were buying that Ford Explorer, which belonged to Jason, you were buying it from some lady that you knew vaguely and couldn't give a description of, and you met her down at Sacky's Pizza. I said, that story's not going to hold anything. As I said, told him, as a matter of fact, I have an eyewitness that's coming into the station that's going to tell me that you were at the scene. Well, I never learned that from Burdick, but I used it. And at that time, Floyd looked at me, and in all seriousness, he said to me, Detective, there couldn't have been. There were no witnesses. So he just implicated himself big time. And, you know, I always said, thank God there are, you know, dumb criminals out there. And this was probably one of the most profane of the dumbest, because to make a statement like that, I don't, he was just, I don't know what he was thinking. So that really started moving our investigation forward at a more rapid speed. Burdick comes in. Ultimately, Burdick's story was, you know, he was just along for the ride. He had nothing to do with this. He actually tried to stop the murder, and he started walking away and wanted no part of that. That was the only part of the whole story that he told us was the truth. That, yes, he was trying to walk away, but he was going to be murdered by Sammy Sanchez. That was truth. So,
what is the situation with the death penalty in Rhode Island and the big issue of federal death penalty possibility of prosecution, and how this crime and these criminals would qualify? Tell us about that.
Rhode Island doesn't have a death penalty statute. However, the federal government does. And because this was a carjacking murder with a high-powered weapon involved, that's where the federal government kicked it in, because of the kidnapping, carjacking, and ultimately the government has on their books the death penalty phase. And because Rhode Island didn't have it, the people of Rhode Island were so outraged at this murder that they wanted their pound of flesh from these individuals. So we attempted to use the federal statute so we could actually get the death penalty. But it's a petition process. It's not just like we show up at the federal government and say, you know, you these people are guilty, put them to death. And it just doesn't happen like that.
Now, with this initiative to try to have these people executed in Rhode Island, you provide a lot of statistics in your book as well about when was the last time somebody was executed in Rhode Island, but also this, the murders compared to executions as well. Can you tell us about a couple of those fascinating statistics that you put in this book to bolster some of your, I guess, claims and arguments in here?
Well, the last time someone has been put to death in Rhode Island was like decades ago. And it had been tossed back and forth between the legislature about putting it back on the books as, you know, a part of the sentencing for something so egregious as an execution. But it was not on the books at that time, so therefore that's why we went to the federal government. Statistics, they always show a story of why things happened or when things happened and what you could do with them. But statistics did not save these two individuals. So we were going to use everything at our power to do what we could to get our pound of flesh for this egregious act.
What was the feeling of the families in their entirety, the Bergesons and the Shute families, in terms of their desire for this?
They were totally on board. Jason's sister, Kelly, started a petition drive and posted a signature boards in all the local markets throughout the Mass in Rhode Island. And people really, really, really got up in arms that, you know, just this was like at the time one of the most egregious acts that Rhode Island had. There have since been others, but at that time, to open the Sunday Providence Journal, which is the major newspaper in Rhode Island, and on the front fold is these five individuals, and Kenneth Day is just staring. And when he's staring like as like the devil's looking at you. And that that just took hold of people, and they really were up in arms about it. Ultimately, the picture that was put in the paper of these five individuals being arraigned, that led to other cases that were opened against them, and ultimately it was Kenneth Day was convicted on another robbery he had committed prior to this carjacking murder. So it did, in essence, close up some cases, and it helped. But just to see that picture in the paper, it was heart-wrenching to see these evil people.
You write in a book about an individual named Ira Nasberg, and he had called the police station the day after the bodies were found. Why did he call? What did he have to say regarding this murder weapon?
Ira Nasberg, he was a unique individual. He was a hanger-on. And when I say hanger-on, he liked to be in the mix of, like, bad people, even though he wasn't a bad person himself. When I say bad, he wasn't a tough guy. He wasn't a murderer. He would basically do whatever these people, Floyd and company, would tell him to do. Ira Nasberg had a clean record. We sought him out because when we ran the background check on the firearm that was used that we recovered from Greg Floyd and Kenneth Day's room, we learned that it was purchased by Ira Nasberg. Ira Nasberg reported several of his guns stolen throughout his life. We ended up tying Ira Nasberg back to Greg Floyd as being a friend of Greg Floyd, and that was when Ira said to me, yeah, I need to talk to you beyond me talking to him in the presence of his attorney. He said, can I come in and talk to you? he did come to the police station on a Friday night. We sat down. I said, listen, I can't talk to you. You've hired an attorney. And he says, I'm waiving all my rights. I want to tell you a story, but how much time am I going to serve? I said, listen, that's way above my pay grade at this point. I will get a hold of the people at the U.S. Attorney's Office. You come back in on Monday. We'll all sit down, and we'll see what we can hammer out, what kind of deal they may or may not be able to get. And ultimately, Ira never came back on Monday, and we learned that over the weekend he had passed away. But Ira definitely liked to be in the mix of bad people, and he was like an easy target because they could just at will tell him to do certain things, and he would do it.
You write about the process that would get this to the death penalty, federal death penalty status. What happens in that pursuit? Tell us what happens.
It's a petition process to have the U.S. government put somebody to death. That petition goes before, at the time it went before, John Ashcroft, who was the U.S. Attorney General, and after review, that was denied our request to have the U.S. government put Floyd to death. That was denied. Floyd, Sanchez, and Harry Burdick ultimately pled guilty to life without parole with no trial. Kenneth Day, and it was ironic because Sanchez never said a word to us. He invoked his right to not speak to us, which was, you know, his constitutional right. He never said a word to us, but ultimately he pled out to life without parole. Kenneth Day was the only one that said, I want to take this to trial. And we did. The United States government took Kenneth Day to trial in a U.S. federal court in Providence. And halfway through the trial process, the defense attorney for Kenneth Day was asked by the judge, Judge Legere, is there a motion to dismiss? And the judge asked this of the defense attorney several times, which made us raise our eyebrows, like, where's this judge going with this? And finally, the lawyer said, yes, Your Honor, I'm asking for a motion to dismiss, at which time the judge said, grant it. And we learned that from the judge's opinion, which I didn't agree with and still don't, that he said that because they didn't have the intent to murder prior to them actually going out and carjacking Jason and Amy, then he was dismissing the case against Kenneth Day.
Now, how did Day respond, and how does prosecution in Rhode Island respond?
Well, we had a backup plan because he was elated, obviously, that he got off on a federal charge. But because he got off on the federal charge, we charged him on the state statute of murder. And we charged him with multiple counts of murder, multiple charges of carjacking. A double jeopardy doesn't apply because it's two distinct and separate jurisdictions. Ultimately, we take Kenneth Day to court on the state murder charges, and he was convicted on all counts and received four consecutive life sentences without parole.
Tell us about Gregory Floyd testifying against Kenneth Day.
During the federal trial, Floyd, I had gone down to Pennsylvania where Floyd was being detained. And I spoke to him at length about clearing his conscience. He did almost do the right thing he stopped the rape of Amy, or the sexual assault of Amy. But then ultimately he killed them. I said, we can offer you nothing else. You are doing life without parole. You're going to die in prison. But Kenneth Day was equally as guilty. Will you help us against our case in Kenneth Day? And Floyd agreed to come back to Rhode Island. and he was going to now testify against Kenneth Day. Once Floyd got to Rhode Island, that quickly did not happen at trial. So we had to use Raymond Anderson as the person that was going to testify against Kenneth Day. And for Raymond's consideration of testifying, he received a reduced sentence.
And what was that reduced sentence?
It was, I believe, in the numbers of like 35 years to serve. So Anderson will get out of prison when he's in his 50s. And the rest are all serving life without parole.
You talked about Kenneth Day and some of his behavior at court regarding families.
Well, again, Kenneth Day was an absolute animal. So when he was brought into court in state court, he faced the family. He was giggling, laughing, blowing kisses to them. Defense table and prosecution table are like side by side. And under his breath, he was constantly trying to bait me into an argument with him. And, you know, we have to keep a cooler head. But the judge did notice, and the sheriffs did advise the judge that what Kenneth Day's actions were once he was being brought into the courtroom and how much this upset the families. And then because of that, he was brought into court on a different manner so that now he no longer faced the families.
Tell us what you write about the circumstance where the perpetrators pled guilty, received the life without parole, but if they would have got the death penalty, you write that with that legal precedent or that what that judge decision would have affected it. Tell us about that.
Well, that would have kicked it into a whole different level of the case, because if we sought the death penalty and Kenneth Day went to trial and was found guilty and the judge had reservations about how the case should be dismissed, I believe that still would be entangled in the court process today. As it was Day's appeal process that lasted for a number of years. He appealed everything under the sun, and ultimately all his appeals were denied, and that last appeal was in 2007, and that was denied. And anything he could come up with, I mean, his job was to try to stay out of jail. Our job was to keep him in jail, and we prevailed.
You talk about the families of the Bergersons and the Schutes. Amy's mother didn't fare well. Amy's sister. Tell us a little bit about the fallout and a little bit about some of the people that went on and continued with life successfully despite this disaster.
Well, again, I try to put the reader's mindset in the shoes of the family. Yes. Having to sit through this process, and it just beat them up to no end. And it affected everybody across the board. We had super highs in the case and then horrible lows in the case. And the ultimate low was when Day's case was dismissed in federal court after we think, you know, that we had a slam dunk going here. That really took its toll on Jason's mom, on Jason's sister. It affected everybody, law enforcement, family. And to move on, yes, in law enforcement, you have to go on because there are other families out there you need to help. But it still lingers in the back of your head that, you know, oh, my God, these families just went through such a heinous time. And, you know, they're never going to get their loved one back. And here are these five individuals. Their life really hasn't been – actually, their life is probably for the better because now they're getting – their meals, they're getting their bed, they're getting everything they need in life. because they're the type of people that really didn't need much in life because they didn't have anything in life. And if they got it, they stole it anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, I talk about a couple of these guys, and Floyd and another were essentially homeless. And like you say, lived in abject poverty, as it were. You write about, because it seems, and you write that some of these guys, they seem to be conflicted, or at least their heinous behavior seemed in conflict with their normal sort of loving behavior that people described. And what you do is you look at the work of Lonnie A. Athens, respected criminologist, and who had studied the nature of violent crime exclusively. And what did you find through Lonnie A. Athens to try to explain how this might have happened?
Well, once the five individuals collectively, their mindset became one, even if that one good person, I don't think he could overrule the other four. And,
right.
and once that animal pack type mentality kicked in, unless you're the dominant person amongst that group and you had the power to persuade, you were not going to persuade those other four to let's turn this whole process around and not commit this murder. Some of them, I don't want to say they had good qualities, because I'll never say that these people, in my eyes, they had nothing good about them. Ray Anderson had a small child. And he, to me, yes, he had a child. He loved his child. Well, if you loved your child, Jason and Amy were somebody's child, and you were part and parcel to this execution. He didn't have, he lost no sleep over this, because the Friday night when we caught Floyd, he was out at a high school graduation party. And, where was the effect it had on him? They all went about their lives the next day. When we spoke to Kenneth Day, he told me that he was getting ready to call the police to tell them about what happened. And I said straight out to him, why didn't you? Well, I don't know. Because that wasn't in his makeup. He was never going to, as he so-called, rat out on any of his friends.
Yeah.
It was a horrible, horrible experience to go through as an investigator, as a father. I had a daughter same age, close to Amy, and just looking at her in that golf course, knowing that her last moments in life were determined by five people she never knew, and it's just a horrible, horrible thing.
The outpouring of emotions for the wakes and the funerals that followed for Jason and Amy were impressive, even to the families that thought they had a lot of friends. It was almost overwhelming, the responses that they had from people, strangers and friends, at these events, weren't they?
It truly was, and well-deserved, the outpouring. And again, I don't know if people who had no history with the Burgessons or the Schutes attended the wakes, and just out of the sheer compassion that some good people have. But there was a tremendous outpouring. I mean, these were two very likable kids who had the world in front of them, and ultimately it was taken by five animals who, wanted to play. They wanted to play God.
Mm-hmm. Well, luckily, through the hard work of your team and people involved in the judicial system, that these four of these people, anyway, will never see the light of day, and one person will receive a significant sentence. Like you say, he likely will receive parole someday. But congratulations on the investigation that moved very quickly and responded appropriately, and obviously, you didn't get the death penalty, but you got the appropriate sentence for these people, that they would be behind bars forever. Congratulations.
Absolutely. And thank you very much. I appreciate that.
I want to thank you for coming on and talking about Murder Without Motive, the Amy Chute and Jason Bergeson story. I know this is on Amazon. Is there a website or a Facebook page for people that might want to look at more information about this? Is there something like that?
I would look under the co-author, Paul Lonardo. It's L-O-N-A-R-D-O. He's written numerous books.
Yes.
He specializes in a lot of true crime stuff. I would Google or any other search engine, Paul Lonardo. He does have a website, and you can link up to anything you want to, any additional information that may be asked.
Absolutely. And we just want to mention, too, Paul Lonardo's co-author. Originally, he was going to come on and talk about this book, but he felt it would be much better for you to come on and with your intimacy with this case to come on and talk about that, and he was absolutely right. So I want to thank you very much, retired Detective Raymond Pingitore, for this interview. You have a great evening, and it was a pleasure speaking with you. Good night.
Thank you, Danny, and also to you. Thank you. Bye.
Good night.